Part 3. In determining the constitutional questions now presented, we must determine whether petitioners are barred from seeking the writ or invoking the protections of the suspension clause, either because of their status, i.e., petitioners' designation by the executive branch as enemy combatants, or their physical location, i.e., their presence at Guantanamo Bay. The government contends that non-citizens designated as enemy combatants and detained in territory located outside our nation's borders have no constitutional rights and no privilege of habeas corpus. Petitioners contend they do have cognizable constitutional rights, and that Congress, in seeking to eliminate recourse to habeas corpus as a means to assert those rights, acted in violation of the suspension clause. We begin with a brief account of the history and origins of the writ. Our account proceeds from two propositions. First, protection for the privilege of habeas corpus was one of the few safeguards of liberty specified in a constitution that at the outset had no Bill of Rights. In the system conceived by the framers, the writ had a centrality that must inform proper interpretation of the suspension clause. Second, to the extent there were settled precedents or legal commentaries in 1789 regarding the extraterritorial scope of the writ or its application to enemy aliens, those authorities can be instructive for the present cases. Section A. The framers viewed freedom from unlawful restraint as a fundamental precept of liberty, and they understood the writ of habeas corpus as a vital instrument to secure that freedom. Experience taught, however, that the common law writ all too often had been insufficient to guard against the abuse of monarchical power. That history counseled the necessity for specific language in the Constitution to secure the writ and ensure its place in our legal system. Magna Carta decreed that no man would be imprisoned contrary to the law of the land. No free man shall be taken or imprisoned or dispossessed or outlawed or banished or in any way destroyed, nor will he go upon him nor send upon him except by the legal judgment of his peers or by the law of the land. Important as the principle was, the barons at Runnymede prescribed no specific legal process to enforce it. Holdsworth tells us, however, that gradually the writ of habeas corpus became the means by which the promise of Magna Carta was fulfilled. The development was painstaking, even by the centuries-long measures of English constitutional history. The writ was known and used in some form at least as early as the reign of Edward I. Yet at the outset it was used to protect not the rights of citizens, but those of the king and his courts. The early courts were considered agents of the crown designed to assist the king in the exercise of his power. Thus, the writ, while it would become part of the foundation of liberty for the king's subjects, was in its earliest use a mechanism for securing compliance with the king's laws. Over time, it became clear that by issuing the writ of habeas corpus, common law courts sought to enforce the king's prerogative to inquire into the authority of a jailer to hold a prisoner. The writ ran into all parts of the king's dominions, for it is said that the king is entitled at all times to have an account why the liberty of any of his subjects is restrained. Even so, from an early date, it was understood that the king, too, was subject to the law. As the writer said of Magna Carta, it means this, that the king is and shall be below the law. And by the 1600s, the writ was deemed less an instrument of the king's power and more a restraint upon it. Still, the writ proved to be an imperfect check. Even when the importance of the writ was well understood in England, habeas relief often was denied by the courts or suspended by Parliament. Denial or suspension occurred in times of political unrest to the anguish of the imprisoned and the outrage of those in sympathy with them. A notable example from this period was Darnell's case, 1627. The events giving rise to the case began when, in a display of the Stuart penchant for authoritarian excess, Charles I demanded that Darnell and at least four others lend him money. Upon their refusal, they were imprisoned. The prisoners sought a writ of habeas corpus, and the king filed a return in the form of a warrant signed by the Attorney General. The court held this was a sufficient answer and justified the subject's continued imprisonment. There was an immediate outcry of protest. The House of Commons promptly passed the Petition of Right, which condemned executive imprisonment without any cause shown and declared that no free man, in any such manner as is before mentioned, shall be imprisoned or detained. Yet a full legislative response was long delayed, The king soon began to abuse his authority again, and Parliament was dissolved. When Parliament reconvened in 1640, it sought to secure access to the writ by statute. The Act of 1640 expressly authorized the use of the writ to test the legality of commitment by command or warrant of the king or the Privy Council. Civil strife and the interregnum soon followed, and not until 1679 did Parliament try once more to secure the writ, this time through the Habeas Corpus Act of 1679. The Act, which later would be described by Blackstone as the stable bulwark of our liberties, established procedures for issuing the writ, and it was the model upon which the habeas statutes of the 13 American colonies were based. This history was known to the framers. It no doubt confirmed their view that pendular swings to and away from individual liberty were endemic to undivided, uncontrolled power. The framers' inherent distrust of governmental power was the driving force behind the constitutional plan that allocated powers among three independent branches. This design serves not only to make government accountable, but also to secure individual liberty. Because the Constitution's separations of power structure, like the substantive guarantees of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments, protects persons as well as citizens, foreign nationals who have the privilege of litigating in our courts can seek to enforce separation of powers principles. That the framers considered the writ a vital instrument for the protection of individual liberty is evident from the care taken to specify the limited grounds for its suspension. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. The non-suspension clause is the original Constitution's most explicit reference to remedies. The word privilege was used perhaps to avoid mentioning some rights to the exclusion of others. Indeed, the only mention of the term right in the Constitution as ratified is in its clause giving Congress the power to protect the rights of authors and inventors. Surviving accounts of the ratification debates provide additional evidence that the framers deemed the writ to be an essential mechanism in the separation of powers scheme. In a critical exchange with Patrick Henry at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, Edmund Randolph referred to the suspension clause as an exception to the power given to Congress to regulate courts. A resolution passed by the New York Ratifying Convention made clear its understanding that the clause not only protects against arbitrary suspensions of the writ, but also guarantees an affirmative right to judicial inquiry into the causes of detention. The resolution of the New York Ratifying Convention noted the convention's understanding that every person restrained of his liberty is entitled to an inquiry into the lawfulness of such restraint and to a removal thereof if unlawful, and that such inquiry or removal ought not to be denied or delayed except when, on account of public danger, the Congress shall suspend the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus. Alexander Hamilton likewise explained that by providing the detainee a judicial forum to challenge detention, the writ preserves limited government. As he explained in the Federalist No. 84, the practice of arbitrary imprisonments have been in all ages the favorite and most formidable instrument of tyranny. The observations of the judicious Blackstone are well worthy of recital. To bereave a man of life or by violence to confiscate his estate without accusation or trial, would be so gross and notorious an act of despotism as must at once convey the alarm of tyranny throughout the whole nation. But confinement of the person by secretly hurrying him to jail, where his sufferings are unknown or forgotten, is a less public, a less striking, and therefore a more dangerous engine of arbitrary government. And as a remedy for this fatal evil, he is everywhere peculiarly emphatical in his encomiums on the Habeas Corpus Act, which in one place he calls the bulwark of the British Constitution. Post-1789 habeas develops in England, though not bearing upon the framers' intent, do verify their foresight. These latter events would underscore the need for structural barriers against arbitrary suspensions of the writ. Just as the writ had been vulnerable to executive and parliamentary encroachment on both sides of the Atlantic before the American Revolution, despite the Habeas Corpus Act of 1679, the writ was suspended with frequency in England during times of political rest after 1789. Parliament suspended the writ for much of the period from 1792 to 1801, resulting in rampant arbitrary imprisonment. Even as late as World War I, at least one prominent English jurist complained that the Defense of the Realm Act of 1914 effectively had suspended the privilege of habeas corpus for any person suspected of communicating with the enemy. In our own system, the suspension clause is designed to protect against these cyclical abuses. The clause protects the rights of the detained by a means consistent with the essential design of the Constitution. It ensures that except during times of formal suspension, the judiciary will have a time-tested device, the writ, to maintain the delicate balance of governments that is itself the surest safeguard of liberty. The clause protects the rights of the detained by affirming the duty and authority of the judiciary to call the jailer to account. The essence of habeas corpus is an attack by a person in custody upon the legality of that custody. The important fact to be observed in regard to the mode of procedure upon this habeas writ is that it is directed to and served upon not the person confined, but his jailer. The separation of powers doctrine and the history that influenced its design therefore must inform the reach and purpose of the suspension clause. Section B. The broad historical narrative of the writ and its function is central to our analysis, but we seek guidance as well from founding era authorities addressing the specific question before us. Whether foreign nationals apprehended and detained in distant countries during a time of serious threats to our nation's security may assert the privilege of the writ and seek its protection. The court has been careful not to foreclose the possibility that the protections of the suspension clause have expanded along with post-1789 developments that define the present scope of the writ. But the analysis may begin with precedents as of 1789, for the court has said that at the absolute minimum, the clause protects the writ as it existed when the Constitution was drafted and ratified. To support their arguments, the parties in these cases have examined historical sources to construct a view of the common law writ as it existed in 1789, as have Amici, whose experience in legal history the court has relied upon in the past. The government argues the common law writ ran only to those territories over which the Crown was sovereign. Petitioners argue that jurisdiction followed the king's officers. Diligent search by all parties reveals no certain conclusions. In none of the cases cited, we find that a common law court would or would not have granted or refused to hear for lack of jurisdiction a petition for writ of habeas corpus brought by a petitioner deemed an enemy combatant under a standard like the one the Department of Defense has used in these cases, and when held in a territory like Guantanamo, over which the government has total military and civil control. We know as well that common law courts entertained habeas petitions brought by enemy aliens detained in England, entertained at least in the sense that the courts held hearings to determine the threshold question of entitlement to the writ. In Shiver and the Spanish Sailors case, the courts denied relief to the petitioners. Whether the holdings in these cases were jurisdictional or based upon the court's ruling that the petitioners were detained lawfully as prisoners of war is unclear. In Ducastro's case, the court granted relief, but that case is not analogous to the petitioners because the prisoner there appears to have been detained in England. To the extent these authorities suggest the common law courts abstained altogether from matters involving prisoners of war, there was greater justification for doing so in the context of declared wars with other nation states. Judicial intervention might have complicated the military's ability to negotiate an exchange of prisoners with the enemy, a wartime practice well known to the framers. We find the evidence as to the geographic scope of the writ at common law informative, but again, not dispositive. Petitioners argue the site of their detention is analogous to two territories outside of England to which the writ did run, the so-called exempt jurisdictions like the Channel Islands and, in former times, India. There are critical differences between these places and Guantanamo, however. As the court noted in Rasul, common law courts granted habeas corpus relief to prisoners detained in the exempt jurisdictions, but these areas, while not in theory part of the realm of England, were nonetheless under the Crown's control. And there is some indication that these jurisdictions were considered sovereign territory. Because the United States does not maintain formal sovereignty over Guantanamo Bay, the naval station there and the exempt jurisdictions discussed in the English authorities are not similarly situated. Petitioners in their amici further rely on cases in which British courts in India granted writs of habeas corpus to non-citizens detained in territory over which the Mughal emperor retained formal sovereignty and control. The analogy to the present case breaks down, however, because of the geographic location of the courts in the Indian example. The Supreme Court of Judicature, the British court, sat in Calcutta, but no federal court sits in Guantanamo. The Supreme Court of Judicature was, moreover, a special court set up by Parliament to monitor certain conduct during the British Raj. That it had the power to issue the writ in non-sovereign territory does not prove that common law courts sitting in England had the same power. If petitioners were to have the better of the argument on this point, we would need some demonstration of a consistent practice of common law courts sitting in England and entertaining petitions brought by alien prisoners detained abroad. We find little support for this conclusion.